This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, our dear listeners out there. We hope you've enjoyed Todd and Russell on the show. We've still got Nick Duke, my fellow hard-traveling fanboy, here on our giant-size edition of Hard-Traveling Fanboys, and Tim Capel, our dear, close, personal, longtime friend. And we are talking about event books. And one thing that Tim never got to was his least favorite event book of the 1990s, before we get into the 2000s. So, Tim, your least favorite event book of the 90s.
All right, so we gotta put the 90s to bed, right? So, as much praise as I've heaped upon Age of Apocalypse, and don't get me wrong, this was a revolutionary major Marvel crossover. They canceled their best-selling series at the time in the mid-1990s. Every single X-Men title got canceled, replaced with these limited series for a four-month duration for the Age of Apocalypse. That was a pretty ballsy move, I think we can all agree. And it ran its course for 4 months, like any good event should, and then it was back to the status quo. There were ramifications of this event that, you know, resonated and carried on to the mainstream Marvel Universe, all well and good. Well, they followed that up with the first major event after Age of Apocalypse was Onslaught, and that certainly had its flaws, okay? And I'm not going to really sit here and defend Onslaught, because it started as this idea of Professor X going bad. And that was when Scott Lobdell was writing the titles. Mark Waid had been brought into the X office. He was writing the other flagship adjectiveless, as they called it, X-Men title. He was only writing that book for about 6 issues, Mark Waid. And he had a very different take on what Onslaught should be. It did not jive with the powers that be over the X-Men office at the time. He wanted it to just be strictly a corruption of Professor Xavier, you know, the ultimate power realized of Charles Xavier manifest in Onslaught, nothing having to do with Magneto or what eventually saw print during this crossover. So Mark Waid was kind of kicked to the curb, and Onslaught became this pretty convoluted thing. That would be my least favorite event of the 90s, if not for the follow-up to that, which was known as
Operation Zero Tolerance.
What a steaming pile of fucking dog shit this was. Oh my God, I hated this so much. I was reading it at the time. Granted, mind you, I was like a 14-year-old kid, had been reading the series, like, you know, for about, I'd been following it as it was published for about 3 to 4 years, I guess, up to this point. So I wasn't like the jaded fanboy that I am now, but Operation Zero Tolerance was the first big event that completely left me cold, completely left me in the dust, was like, what are they doing? Fuck this shit. Because, you know, the X-Books, the X-Men in the 90s was all about the illusion of change. It was about, let's try to, you know, drip feed some revelations about major characters without going all the way with it. Let's, you know, titillate the fans. Let's kind of make it seem like we're heading towards something and we're going to actually reveal some major plot points and some background about these enigmatic characters that we've introduced without going all the way. And that's kind of what, that's the foundation that the X books were built on in the 90s. It was all about this, like I said, illusion of change. And Operation Zero Tolerance started with this great premise of, you know, this new character, Bastion, who was like this government official, this very mysterious new character who had been introduced about a year prior, had coerced the government into essentially declaring war on the X-Men, who was this outlaw mutant faction that nobody could quite get a handle on up to this point, and he decided we need to do something about this. And so he got, you know, his government operatives on board with this. He had ordinary humans who were volunteering to undergo this transformative process and becoming sentinels, and these were called Prime Sentinels, where they were like these sleeper agents. You didn't know, you know, who you could trust, and ordinary humans all of a sudden were manifesting these abilities and
essentially turning into sentinels, correct?
Essentially turning into sentinels, yeah. And you couldn't just, you know, annihilate them the way you would the old, you know, 20-foot robots, because these are basically ordinary humans who, you know, you're going to kill or mortally wound if you engage in combat. So it was like this conflict that it presented the characters with. So it started out with this pretty great premise and just devolved into total nothingness. Like, the main thrust of the story as told in, like, the flagship X-Men title was Iceman and his amazing friends for four issues. It was really boring and, you know, uneventful and just a whole lot of just wandering in place. Just nothing happened. They were in this holding pattern throughout the entire duration of this event. The major characters who you were most invested in were featured in, like, the Wolverine solo series, and still not a whole lot happened. It was just, again, running in place. It was just such a waste of time, and they had built it up as, you know, this is going to change the landscape of the X universe. It's going to be this major game changer. You know, you want to be on board for this, and it did absolutely none of that. It was the worst thing I'd ever read up to that point. Again, I was only 14 years old, not as jaded as I am now, but it totally turned me off this series that had pretty much gotten me into comics in the first place, and that's saying a lot. So that gets my vote for worst event series of the 90s.
You had zero tolerance for the series, one might say.
Puts on sunglasses, the theme starts to play.
For the series, which came to affectionately be known as Zero Intelligence, har, har, har.
Hey. Found it!
On newsgroups, circa 1997, 1998, when, you know, that was a thing.
Well, that puts a very, I wouldn't say a tidy bow, but that puts a rather ugly bow on the 90s.
Can I just say, before we leave the 90s behind, unrecognized, uncelebrated major event was Operation Galactic Storm. Have either of you guys read this?
No. I'm not aware of what it is.
Okay, not to harp on it. I promise I won't take too much time praising this, but essentially it was a major event in the Avengers-related titles in the early 90s, like 1991, 1992. So, again, every major character, every series was a franchise back then, as we touched upon. So it was a 19-part crossover, which that caught a lot of flack at the time, but looking back, it's sort of like 19 parts, that's it. So
exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's that's so, like, who cares? You know, that's nothing compared to the events that they do today. But it crossed over into, all right, Avengers, Avengers West Coast, Captain America, Wonder Man, who actually had a series at the time, a solo series. What else? Iron Man, Thor, and I think that was it. So it actually it crossed over into a lot of different series. So even though it was 19 parts, it didn't actually last that long. It was only like 2 or 3 months, really. And the central premise, it was really simple, okay? So the Shi'ar Empire is going to war with the Kree Empire. The only reason that the Avengers and the Earth gets involved in this at all is because they are using Stargate technology, which is an intergalactic teleportation transport thing, you know, to wage their war across galaxies. And using the Stargate, it kind of depletes the Earth's sun. So it runs the risk of destabilizing the sun to the point that it might, like, explode and annihilate, you know, the Milky Way galaxy.
Which would be bad.
Which would be bad for us, but in the context of this intergalactic war, you know, the Shi'ar and the Kree Empires are like, well, that might just be collateral damage, so we would frown upon that, but who cares in the grand scheme of things. And so the Avengers get involved, and they're like, hey, whoa, we're not cool with this. So, you know, they represent this delegation from Earth. They're on this diplomatic mission to try to smooth things over and say, look, you guys do what you want to do, but quit using the Stargate because we don't want to be caught up in this and have, you know, the Earth explode because you guys have a disagreement. And gradually they get more and more sucked into this conflict. So it kind of has this interesting premise, and it's, you know, a bit more logical than you might expect from a major Marvel event series. And it was written by the major architects of the Avengers series at the time, Bob Harris, who, say what you will about him as an editor, but I feel like he doesn't get a whole lot of credit as just a writer and a creator. He wrote the Avengers through pretty much the first half of the 90s, in a run that is not especially popular with a lot of people, but I have a great deal of affection for, and I might actually go to bat for in a Place to Be Nation article. Don't hold me to that, but I'm kind of thinking about it. Mark Gruenwald, who we talked about before on Captain America. Tom DeFalco, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics at the time. He was also writing Thor. So there was a whole lot of hands in the pot, but they really knew what they were doing, and they knew the story that they wanted to tell. So, you know, it's not like it was getting pulled in all these different directions. They set out with an objective, they told their story, and at the end of the day, you know, it gave us something that holds up pretty well. You know, if you're not into the type of story that they were trying to tell, then it might leave you cold, but I mean, it's damn consistent, if nothing else. So if you've never read it before, and if you're interested in Marvel cosmic stuff and Marvel politics of, you know, the different races of the Marvel Universe, check out Operation Galactic Storm. I would highly recommend it as a close second behind my favorite, Age of Apocalypse. You know, really good stuff, really underrated, and doesn't get kind of the due that it deserves, I feel like.
Excellent. I kind of feel like that entire era of Marvel, you know, certainly they're republishing Infinity Gauntlet because of the movie tie-in, but I feel like the entire like early 90s pre-collapse era of Marvel has been kind of unfairly lumped in with the post-collapse era of Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really unfortunate, because there were some good stories back then. I mean, in the X, not just in the X line, but in Spider-Man, but in the Avengers, and there were some great cosmic stuff going on at the time.
It's crazy, actually. I wasn't going to mention this, but just briefly, like, in the 90s, Thor as a series is such a complete blind spot to me that it's insane. Like, people think of Thor being under the thumb of Tom DeFalco, and they did Thunderstrike, which was the spinoff series of Thor in the 90s, but in fact, Tom DeFalco only wrote Thor up until about, like, 1993, and then he was off that series, and it was taken over by, of all people, Jim Starlin and Ron Mars. And they did, like, 10 issues straight of nothing but crossovers into, you know, Infinity Crusade, which we haven't even touched upon, really, the Infinity Trilogy that took place in the 90s. And then it went into a crossover that no one remembers called Blood and Thunder. And then, like, Roy Thomas was writing Thor for a good probably 15 issues. And then Warren Ellis did it for, like, 4 issues. And then Bill Messner-Loebs did it for a while. And it was like, literally no one has ever talked about any of these runs. I mean,
and that's
looking
partly,
back on the series, like, it is such a blind spot, not just for me, but no one talks about this.
Because it's hard to find those runs even collected, because that period, like, everybody looks back at the 80s stuff across the board in comics with fondness, whether earned or unearned. People look back at the 80s as kind of a creative nadir of comics or what have you, but that early 90s period, the good stuff that happened gets so, and it's hard, and some of that stuff, like you said, we've never read, so we don't know if it was good or bad. But
I mean,
so much
I
that
have these issues and I don't remember them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've read these issues and I'm like, oh yeah, that's, I mean,
it's a thing that happened.
No one talks about this. I read the issues, I have the issues, and I'm like, maybe they were good, maybe they were bad. No one talks about this. So it's just funny how there's these massive blind spots, because there was just so much product in the 90s.
Definitely. Well, let's go into the 2000s, and we're going to, right off the bat, we're going to hit the ground running. After a little dry spell of big events, Marvel came out in the early 2000s or mid-2000s with House of M, which bled into the next event that we're going to talk about, which is Civil War, an event that should create some interesting discussion. I'm going to lay out on this one and let Nick talk for a bit, and then you and Tim and Nick can kind of go back and forth on this one a little bit. So, Nick, get us started on Civil War, the premise, and how it played out.
Well, but before we start with that, I'd actually kind of like to get a little bit of Tim's perspective, because I've read House of M, but I haven't read Avengers Disassembled. So I feel like, I don't know, maybe my understanding of where the Marvel Universe was at that time is kind of, muted a little bit because of my lack of knowledge of Disassembled. So, Kev, why don't you, fill me in and any uninformed readers in on Disassembled and where it left the Marvel Universe leading into House of M and then Civil War.
Well, honestly, Nick, I think you're okay having read Civil War in isolation. It didn't really pay off a whole lot of events from House of M or Avengers Disassembled before that. The only thing you really have to know going in is, through Avengers Disassembled, you had pretty much the old guard disbanding. So the Avengers were, like, essentially Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, and a handful of B-list characters.
Thor, who leading into Civil War, was no longer around. This was during one of the many Ragnarok cycles, so Thor was dead or not, you know, whatever you want to call it, just not in the Avengers picture, so to speak, I guess would be the best.
Yeah, exactly. So what Avengers, this symbol did was it took the Avengers and what they were up to that point and said, that's the end of this era. And Thor in his own series got basically killed. was retired. Let's just say retired.
Killed's a better term.
Yeah, killed, retired. He was taken off the board for a few years. And what got the Avengers back together was, you know, this prison break at the Raft and the series New Avengers that Brian Michael Bendis and I guess who was it, David Finch started in like 2005, 2006.
I know it was Bendis, but the artist escapes me at the moment. But it was absolutely Bendis because they kind of gave it's really weird the way the whole thing played out because they gave Bendis kind of the keys to the Avengers kingdom, and then Civil War wasn't Bendis's work at all, which
yeah,
kind of feels weird in hindsight, but at the time I was okay with, you know, it's one of those things.
Well, yeah, it is one of those things because, like, you know, New Avengers got started, and it was the beginning of a new era, which was Captain America and Iron Man coming together again and saying, we need to start the Avengers back up, but it can't be like it was before.
Yeah.
So they recruit all these A-listers, essentially, into the team and decided to turn the Avengers into the Marvel equivalent of what the JLA was for DC.
Right on.
So
this is around the same time that we have Spider-Man, Wolverine, you know, like the real heavy hitters coming in, the A-listers, if you will.
Exactly.
Not so much the heavy hitters in terms of power set, but I guess in terms of public
marketability.
Perception. Yeah.
Marketability, for sure, yeah. So it was like Captain America, Iron Man, they were the backbone of this team, and they recruit Spider-Man, Wolverine, Spider-Woman, who was just sort of a character that Brian Michael Bendis had a preoccupation, a fascination with, which, you know, I don't say that mockingly. I mean, she deserved to get some due, I guess.
And then he created his own version over in the Ultimate Universe and had just as much of a preoccupation with her as he did with anybody else.
Yeah, so, you know, you can call it one of his pet characters, but, you know, every writer has these tics, and that's, you know, that's fine. That's comics for you. And, you know, God, who else was in that early iteration of New Avengers? The Sentry, who was like the Marvel version of Superman, and they brought in, like, oh God, who else? I'm trying to remember. This is such like a blank spot also in my early comics or late comics fandom, I should say. But anyway, this new Avengers team is assembled, and House of M is the first big event to feature these guys, and it's all centered on Scarlet Witch and the fact that she had led to the downfall of the previous iteration of the Avengers, and what do we do with her now? Because she's still off a rocker, and ultimately, she reshapes the world in her image because she's still, you know, a little bit insane. And how do we get back from that? And that was sort of the premise behind House of M. And so throughout all of this, Captain America and Iron Man are pretty much on the same page. And it sort of built up this partnership and this understanding between the two of them that comes to a head in Civil War, which is where the breakdown is introduced. And Civil War starts with the big high concept is there's this very small-scale conflict between a team called the New Warriors and a longtime Marvel villain called Nitro, whose powers are explodes.
Yeah. I'm very familiar with the whole build-up to Civil War. Like,
so you know how that plays out.
Yeah,
so
Nitro, I mean, let me kind of give you my introduction to Civil War. Mm-hmm. So you know, I had kind of gotten into comics through the Ultimate Universe. Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, Ultimate Fantastic Four, Ultimates 1 and 2. And through going into my local comic shop to pick up my Ultimate books while I was in college, I started seeing the promotional posters for Civil War. And the guy who owned the shop was very friendly, you know, very cool guy, Kelly Poole, who still owns Empire Comics in Enterprise, Alabama, where Russell gets most of his pull list from. We got to talking. He was kind of telling me the idea behind Civil War. He was kind of explaining it to me, and I was still kind of like, I don't know. I mean, it sounds interesting, but I'm not sure I want to get it, you know, because I had never really delved into the 616 Marvel Universe before. Well, then when he told me that Mark Millar was writing it, I was like, okay, Millar writes Ultimate Iron Man, he writes Ultimate Cap, and you know, the Ultimates. And so I felt like if I was ever going to make the jump, it felt like that would be the time at which it would be the least, I don't know, difficult to make the jump. And so when I made the jump, I was so naive as a young comic fan. I was like, all right, I want to read Civil War. He's like, well, what do you want to read? Just the main title or, like, all the tie-ins? I was like, tie-ins? Explain. He was like, it's basically this whole side stories that affect the main plot. And I think he was kind of overselling me at that point. I was like, I want to read everything. So I bought Civil War, Civil War Frontline, and every single tie-in throughout the entirety of the series. So I was there for everything that happened.
Okay. Well, I guess you were the ideal customer then for Marvel at the time. Because
the idiot customer.
Honestly, well, I wouldn't say idiot. I mean,
okay.
The thing about...
But there were Ghost Rider, Blade, and Heroes for Hire tie-ins to Civil War. You know what I mean? Like, the Spider-Man tie-ins, the Iron Man tie-ins, the Cap tie-ins, even the X-Men tie-ins all made sense. But, like, Heroes for Hire, Blade, Ghost Rider, you know what I mean?
Cable and Deadpool had a tie-in to Civil
War. Sure did. Had both issues.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call you an idiot. It's just the fact that, you know, this was the first time that Marvel... This was when Marvel jumped back on that big event bandwagon. I mean, these had fallen out of fashion after the 90s. The last big event that Marvel had done was a thing called Maximum Security that no one remembers except for maybe myself.
And Civil War, to my knowledge, kind of came around the same time around this Infinite Crisis over at DC. So you've kind of got both companies.
Yeah,
it was within a year, kind of rediscovering that big event format. You know.
Yeah, that's what they did. They had tested the waters with Avengers Disassembled, which at the end of the day, that was a very Avengers centric event. House of M was the first time they said, okay, we're doing big events again. But again, it was still contained to House of M, the miniseries, which I think it was a 7-part miniseries, and it had a couple of other spinoff, again, just limited series. It didn't bleed over into regular titles, really. It was just a series of miniseries, which was House of M.
Yeah.
And that was... I mean, there were a few that crossed over into regular titles, but those were few and far between. But that turned out to be a resounding success, and they said, okay, we're back. You know, we do big event storytelling again, so we're going to do Civil War. It's going to be a 7-part limited series. We're going to do a companion series called Civil War Frontline, and we're going to cross over to anything and everything in between. And I wouldn't call you an idiot for buying into that, because it was intended to be very user-friendly, very accessible, with very few barriers to entry for new readers.
And, you know, I actually felt that, because when I came over from the Ultimate Universe, I felt like the versions of Cap and Iron Man that I were reading in Civil War felt familiar enough where I wasn't lost.
Yeah, they were very iconic depictions of these characters. They were kind of distilled, boiled down to their core. It said, you know, we don't care if you've been reading and following these characters for 5 minutes or for 5 years or for 50 years for that matter. It was like, this is going to be the thing that pleases all the people all the time.
Absolutely.
And it's arguable whether or not they did that, but your impressions coming in as a new reader, I think, is exactly what they wanted. That was who it was targeted for.
And the concept totally hooked me. It wasn't, like, even as a young comic reader, I was familiar with the concept of heroes fighting heroes, but it was always more of a misunderstanding than it was, I guess, a philosophical, you know, real divide between the characters. And this one felt real. And it gave you an aspect where every reader who read that story had a side that they favored, you know, that they could kind of see the aspect of. I was in the minority in that I was totally pro-Reg with Iron Man on that story. Like, I felt like, you know, I can kind of see where he's coming from. These heroes need to be licensed. They need to come from a standpoint of responsibility. They need to be trusted to protect the public interest and not just be whoever's running around out there, you know. Cap's anti-Reg, but that doesn't mean that, like, every hero that's anti-Reg or doesn't want to register is going to be as proficient or as safe as Captain America is.
Well, and I think that's what the problem is with a series like this, is logically, sensibly, everyone is going to come down on the side of pro-registration. Like,
that's the thing. Every comic fan I've ever talked to, for the most part, has come down anti-Reg. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's what I mean. Like, in the real world, if these people actually existed, like, you and I, all of us would be like, holy shit, these people need to be fucking registered. You know, this is insane that people are running around. It's vigilante justice. They're just policing themselves, doing whatever they want to. Of course they need to be regulated by the government or some kind of authoritative body. That just makes sense, in order for me to feel like I'm not going to shit my pants at night trying to sleep. You know, like, I mean, that's just the logical conclusion. So in order to try to make it seem like even a sensible, balanced debate, it seems like the writers went out of their way to vilify the pro-registration side, and they were doing all this really underhanded stuff and, like, this, you know, kind of clandestine, you know, things that we're going to, like, frown upon as...
Well, I think the writers were very much using the story as an outlet... A sounding board for their own feelings on, you know, the post-9/11 politics of the world, the Patriot Act and all that. I can understand that criticism to a certain degree, but I also felt like as much as they tried to vilify the pro-reg guys, I still felt like there were elements in their motivations that made sense, made them relatable enough to where you could still take their side, not view one side as completely wrong over the other side.
I was just saying, to play devil's advocate, though, for what Tim's saying, you can make that everything you just said about Iron Man and the pro-reg side could be applied to countless villains in comics. Magneto, Lex Luthor, so many of what we would consider to be villains, and I think that's probably what he's saying, is that Iron Man in the series, and I even got that when I was reading it, as I felt, and I was manipulated the same way that the average reader would be, and that I sided with Cap, because... You know, sure, you can make the argument of pro-reg, but Iron Man was doing everything in such a heavy-handed, militaristic way that I felt like it was clearly presented that, hey, you're not supposed to like this guy.
But to me, I felt like the thing that you had on the pro-reg side that you didn't necessarily have on the anti-reg side, and yes, I know Cap had, like, Luke Cage or whatever, who was kind of a second-in-command, but I felt like you had Reed Richards there, who was kind of trying to be the conscience of the pro-reg side. Yeah, he was with Iron Man on all these initiatives, but every time Iron Man would bring up, you know, whatever idea he had for the future, you know, Reed would be there to kind of help him figure it out, but he was also kind of saying, hey, well, you know, is this really what we need to be doing? How is this going to look? And so you had that human element that I felt like Reed really brought in, especially with a character in Reed Richards that I had never really, I guess, cared about, for lack of a better term, in the past. But I felt like he was almost He was almost Tony Stark's conscience during that series. Not necessarily to an effective degree, because obviously, as we all, as those of us who have read the series and read the follow-up know, Tony Stark was probably a bit more culpable in the events of a civil war and after that than he led us to believe initially, but Reed was at least there still trying to fight the good fight and trying to do the right thing, which is, you know, I guess Reed's ultimate character flaws that he sees the best in people.
I kind of actually agree with all that, and I think my problem with Civil War was a lot of the conflict that they introduced seemed very manufactured. It was like Greg said, it was, we were predisposed to side with Cap and the anti-registration forces because of the very heavy-handed nature of the pro-registration side. So they were doing things like, okay, we're going to detain all of these supervillains and throw them in the negative zone, which is like the equivalent of these supermax prisons where it's like Guantanamo Bay and they're going to be interrogated and all this shit.
And that was very intentional, the allegory.
I'm sure it was, but to me as a reader, I'm kind of like, okay, they're trying to make me think like these guys are such douchebags for doing this, but I'm sort of like at the same time thinking, who gives a shit? Do I care that Dr. Octopus or Carnage or all these horrible villains are being detained in the negative zone where they can't?
Do you care that they're being detained in the negative zone? Maybe not, but do you care that they're being outfitted with restraining collars and then turned against anti-reg heroes in a new age version of the Thunderbolts? That kind of brings a little bit of edge back into it to me.
Well, that sort of came later, but I'm just thinking like in terms of
the pro-reg version of the Thunderbolts came during Civil War. That was in the midst of the storyline.
All right, that's fair enough, but I guess I'm thinking in terms of like Spider-Man, you know, Peter Parker and his position and all this.
Absolutely.
It's his tipping, he was pro-registration because he was buddy buddy with Tony Stark and Iron Man.
He had been seduced by the I'm trying to think, by the gravitas of who Tony Stark is and what he is. Not even so much about what Tony stands for, but like just who Tony Stark is, you know?
The power and the ego, and that was a great story that they were telling, where he was buddy buddy with Tony Stark.
Fantastic. A story that should have lasted longer. The whole Spider-Man unmasked thing is one of the greatest untapped potential storylines in comics history, in my
opinion. I'm with you 100%. Where it loses me is the payoff to that. Like, Spider-Man is supposed to be the everyman, right? The relatable guy. Like, I could see myself or anyone who I know, you know, being seduced by that power and just that influence of Tony Stark and, like, you're nobody. And then all of a sudden, this guy is, like, recognizes this potential within you that has never been realized. And you're like, holy crap, you know, I could see that going, you know, a long way. And like you said, being very seductive. And what turns it, what you know, the tipping point for Peter Parker was his greatest enemies who had beguiled him for years and years.
The version of the Thunderbolts, I just alluded to.
Yeah, that version of the Thunderbolts, these guys being detained in Supermax prison and negative and this, that, and the other. He's like, well, that's not right. It's like, really? Like, that's what you give a shit about? That's going to turn the tide for you? Like, it just didn't really ring true for him as a, you know, relatable.
And to me, it kind of did, because if you remember, that version of Thunderbolts was being led by Norman Osborn, and it's that moment for Peter where he kind of stops and goes, you know, whatever I may think of the cause I'm fighting for, I'm fighting alongside Norman freaking Osborn, you know? And I think for me, I always read it like Peter had come to the decision of the side he was on, not easily. Like, I think it was had always been a, you know, a very personal struggle for him, and one that he kind of slightly sided with Tony over Cap, and then when he saw Norman Osborn, Matt Gargan, Venom, Bullseye, you know, people like that who were kind of being unleashed
on anti-Reg heroes who he had once counted amongst his friends and allies. It was that kind of turned Peter, you know, into, you know, the more anti-Reg hero. And plus I think he made an idealistic decision to begin with, as opposed to a realistic decision. He made the idealistic decision of wanting to support Tony and do everything right and be there for the American people. And then I think he realized what he had always feared all along: Mary Jane, Aunt May, what have you, all those characters, all those friends and family he has who are now in grave mortal danger, which only got followed up in one storyline of Spider-Man after Civil War.
Before One More Day,
you know, where he kind of went the Back in Black thing, which I know Greg hates because of the movie, but, you know, it kind of made sense because he was in a darker place and all that. But, you know, like, I felt like that whole story had so much potential for Spider-Man. And while I love Civil War as a whole, you know, I kind of have to agree that it has some faults, whether it be how they handled the Spider-Man aspect of the story, and especially Civil War is a 7-issue limited series. 6 issues of it, I'm a huge fan of. The 7th issue, where it finally comes down for the knockdown, drag-out fight between Cap and Iron Man, and the ending is kind of a cop-out, to be honest. Like,
yeah,
I'm not asking for Captain America to behead Iron Man or anything, but, like, to have one of them quit and just give in is a bit much. And yeah, it gave us a pretty cool death of Cap story and his whole return with Ed Brubaker, but the ending really, really rang hollow for me, to the point where, like, while I'll defend the story as a whole, it's kind of hard for me to, like, put it up there in the upper tier of event books.
And that's the thing. I think if nothing else, if the ending had been anything different, I would be able to, you know, recognize or acknowledge the strengths of the series and what it was trying to accomplish and be okay with that. But the ending really does die on the vine for me. It was like, again, I talk about how manufactured a lot of these decisions of the major characters throughout the course of the series were. That really
absolutely,
you know, is the exclamation point on all of it.
I mean,
was
you want to talk
Captain
about
America all of a sudden deciding, oh,
that was a decision.
We don't know what we're fighting for anymore because there's collateral damage in the city. Well, no shit. I mean, that's any...
Yeah, exactly. That was a decision he would have realized and come to weeks before he actually did. Like, it doesn't...
He knew what the fuck he was signing up for. I mean,
yeah, exactly. To me, a much more logical ending to that story is, you know, Cap recognizing that, and whichever side wins, they win. I'm not asking for one side to murder the other, for God's sakes. I'm not asking them to, you know, become irredeemable or anything, but, like,
sure,
there's nothing wrong with having a clear winner in that physical confrontation, you know? You still could have had Tony ultimately conquer, sent Cap off to jail, and had Cap die. And even then, that might have added gravitas to the whole, like, Tony Stark feels guilty after Cap's, you know, shooting and everything.
From an outside perspective, reading it at the time, it felt to me, and I know this would never have happened in a million years, but keep in mind, this was pre-movie. It felt to me like Iron Man, who I feel comfortable in saying, in the mainstream sense, is probably at that time was a B-level character at best in terms of mainstream knowledge and things like that. It felt
completely,
to me like they were turning him
so
into a villain.
So was everyone Spider-Man or Wolverine at the time, you know?
Right. No, but I'm saying it felt to me like they were turning Iron Man into the new villain of the Marvel
universe. And it especially felt that way if you read some of the Civil War follow-ups. There was one called Civil War: The Confession, where...
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's Tony Stark talking to Cap's dead body, and he never comes out and says, "Hey, Steve, I engineered this entire situation because I own damage control now, and I can make money off of all these, you know, superhero fights when they need cleanup." And he never says, "Hey, Steve, I own the copyrights to all of the initiative to have super teams in each state." But it is heavily, heavily implied that Iron Man had engineered maybe not the entire situation from the get-go, but at least once certain factors came into play, Tony knew, like, hey, here's how this is going to go, here's how it can benefit me, and it played the whole thing like a, kind of like a fiddle. And that's the way, yeah. Like, I am, you know, even though I'm pro, when I read the story, I sided with Tony as pro-Reg. After the fact, I still kind of like to read it like Tony kind of knew what he was doing all along, because it's a more interesting story to me. Now,
oh, no doubt. That
the problem with that is, like,
the reading, yeah.
Yeah, the problem with that is, like, I stopped reading halfway through Secret Invasion, so, like, there's no end game to that in the way that I read it. There's no end game to, does Tony become this Foy Raz villain, or does he kind of circle back around and redeem himself? So I can't really, like, defend that as, like, an overarching story, but I like to read Civil War as Tony is kind of manipulating the entire situation from the get-go because he's Tony Stark and he thinks he's smarter than everyone.
Yeah, and it's like his ultimate endgame is not his philosophical position on this issue. It's just
but
his
personal
shrewd
benefit.
Business. His
yep.
shrewd business sense and his yeah, his personal gain.
Which is why
which a
which
lot
is,
of billionaires you can
which
look
is,
at.
And like I said, which is why Reed Richards is so important, because you have Tony who's kind of playing everything from a shrewd businessman personal benefit standpoint, and Reed Richards is there providing all the idealistic, you know, noble backings for Tony's cause. So Tony has all these things that, like, undoubtedly benefit him, but he can present them in such a way because he has Reed Richards there to tell him kind of how to present things.
It felt to me like they were kind of building Stark to be like the Marvel version of Lex Luthor, which they later kind of shoehorned Norman Osborn into being.
Yeah, it kind of depends on the version of Lex Luthor you're looking at. Are we looking at, you know...
Well, I'm talking about the modern interpretation.
Yeah, exactly. And I can see that easily, especially, you know, given the allegory to current Lex Luthor, you know, joining the Justice League and everything. It makes sense. Now, granted, you have to understand, anybody listening to this, this all exists in a pre-2008 world where Tony yeah. Stark, the character, is not as popular or is a totally
he
different animal from the Robert Downey Jr. Tony Stark. It's not the same. They have elements, but they're not anywhere close to each other.
I think what you have to understand is post-Civil War, Iron Man, Tony Stark, was intentionally or not made out to be such a villain
yeah.
that the following year of stories was nothing but pretty much the Tony Stark getting his
yep.
ass kicked tour.
Which led into Secret Invasion, which was
yeah.
a Skrull invasion of Earth that Tony Stark was blamed for.
Well,
because,
hang on. We can actually back up prior to that, which was World War Hulk, you know, the Hulk coming back
God.
To Earth, exacting his revenge on the Illuminati. Which
and beating the hell out of Iron Man.
Beating the shit out of Iron Man.
Which
and then
Tony was totally
Thor,
blamed for.
Totally blamed for it. Thor, when he came back.
Returning and finding out that Tony had cloned him during
had
Civil War.
Cloned him.
And used his clone to blow a hole through the middle of Goliath, yes.
So he whipped his ass. Who else? Like,
Nova?
I think... No, there you go, yeah, Richard Rider Nova.
Came back and kind of whooped Tony's ass as well.
He sure did, yeah. So that was like a year's worth of storytelling was nothing but Iron Man getting his ass kicked.
Because post-Civil War, he actually became Director of S.H.I.E.L.D. The
uh-huh.
Iron Man solo series was retitled as Iron Man Director of S.H.I.E.L.D. So
yeah.
Tony kind of had this new position that you were led to believe he had kind of wanted all along, you know?
Yeah, so it was sort of like, let's give him his comeuppance, let's humble this guy a little bit to bring him back down to Earth, and then we can build him back up and try to humanize him a little bit, because humanity has pretty much gone out the window when it comes to this guy after everything that happened.
Well, I felt like humanity never went out the window, because everything that he did, they always left that area of gray in it, if that makes any sense. Like I said, he never really came out and said, hey, Steve, I own damage control, so I did this whole thing. It was just like, you know, heavy implications. If that
yeah,
makes sense.
But it seemed we were talking earlier about Armageddon 2001 and how all the hints were leading in one direction, and then they slammed the door on that direction and said, "Hey, here's something completely different." And that's kind of where it felt with that. Now, in the interest of fairness, and kind of tying this together to the bigger theme, at the same time that all this is going on, or maybe a little bit before, or maybe a little bit after, but at the same time, essentially, DC was doing a very similar character arc with Batman. With regards to Batman going back to a very good Mark Waid Justice League story called Tower of Babel, where it was revealed that Batman had constructed means to defeat all the other members of the Justice League.
Greg, do we have time to cover this?
Probably not. we are desperately out of time.
I mean, we just talked 45 minutes about Civil War. I could do an hour on Infinite Crisis. I mean, what are we doing right now?
I have no idea. But I guess the long story short, perhaps an illustration of my bias, I thought that the handling of the Bruce Wayne character arc throughout that whole process was better executed than the handling of Tony Stark from beginning to end.
Well, to be fair, Bruce Wayne had been a more exposed character than Tony Stark, so that you got his motivation and his thought process all throughout that, whereas Tony Stark, unless you're reading Iron Man, which a lot of people probably weren't, didn't get, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you're right. I was going to say, like, the difference, it comes down to Batman is an A-list character, and you can take Bruce Wayne...
In pre-2008, Batman, I mean, like, when we have these discussions about, like, pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe, Marvel Comics, people need to understand that, like, when we talk about Iron Man or Captain America or Thor now, like, the perception and concept of those characters now compared to what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, it's night and day. I mean, yeah. Let's be honest. Okay, let's turn the clock back to 2000. Let's go 15 years ago. How many true A-list characters were there in comics? I would argue Batman, Superman, maybe Wonder Woman, Spider-Man and Wolverine, and those are my only A-list characters.
And the X-Men as a concept.
But no individual part is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you can make the argument Batman, Superman. I would argue Wonder Woman has kind of fallen out of that range. Spider-Man, mm-hmm. Wolverine, Iron Man, Captain America, and possibly Thor. Like if you really want to make that argument, because of what the movies have done. And so when we talk about these concepts, you know, years later, like the idea of having Iron Man, like we were just saying, compared to Batman, people will listen to it now and go, that kind of makes sense. But back then, like, the exposure level that was given to an Iron Man story compared to a Batman story is like, it's like night and day. You know what I mean? It's like the Batman story was easily three times as exposed as the Iron Man story.
I mean, you can take Batman and you can take him in any direction you want to creatively.
Exactly.
But the fact of the matter is people have this iconic vision of who Batman is as a character that you more or less know that there's an understanding that the reset button is going to be pressed at some point. I think he's
going to see the error of his ways if he's done anything wrong. Right.
He has earned that distinction at this point. With Iron Man, you didn't know. I mean, if you took Tony Stark in some new direction, it was like maybe, you know, well, maybe that's just
redefine
the way that character is now. Maybe he's a bad guy. Maybe he's a douchebag like they're writing him. You didn't know that he was going to be reset to any particular point in time. I mean, yeah, he's one of the original characters of the Marvel Universe, but how many people really recognize or care about that? I mean, he was a lot more flexible creatively as a character than somebody like Batman or Superman. Just like Nick said, he wasn't on that same stage
prior to
2008.
Yeah. And I would love, I mean, like, you can't have it now because of who we are, like, as comic fans, but how cool would it be to go back and read some of the early 2000s or 90s stories with fresh eyes now? Like,
oh yeah,
thinking of Iron Man or Captain America or Thor as a concept, as these great, you know, pillars of comicdom, how awesome would that be? You know, obviously we'll never be able to do it, but I just think about that a lot. Like, how cool it would be to read something like Civil War now and think of Captain America and Iron Man as these, you know, these iconic characters.
Yeah, they really what they are today. Yeah, through those eyes of what they are today on the greater, you know, the bigger pop culture landscape and what they represent, you know, through that lens. Absolutely.
But to
we're the Nick, we're running out of time, man. We've got to wrap things up.
Damn it.
Real quick, very, very quick. The ingredients of a good event. Tim, go first.
I would say you put character first. And I think that DC, by and large, has done a better job over the years, historically, of doing big event comics than Marvel has. Marvel seems to take the idea of, let's take a high concept and a hot creator and build an event around this. And, you know, that's produced good results in a vacuum in years past. But I think if you take character first and decide that, okay, we're going to use this as a culmination of everything that's come before and what we're trying to eventually build towards and the stage that we're setting through the publishing plan that we've designed through, you know, editorial meetings and the like, and decide that the linchpin of all of this is going to be this particular story that we're telling. And I think a good example of that would be what we talked about, Death of Superman, Funeral for a Friend, Reign of the Superman. That was a great three-act storyline for a particular character that really holds up well to this day and is especially timeless and is held up through, you know, the various trends and different, you know, ebbs and flows of the industry as a whole. I think that that's a great model for big event storytelling.
Nick, what about you, my friend? Ingredients of a good event.
Much like Tim said, it has to be character first. You can get action in a solo comic series. You can get action in some solo comic series that is just as good as the action in team books or crossover books or what have you. But if you're going to do this giant universe-wide crossover, it has to impact each character on a fundamental level. And to that end, I will leave you with my favorite quote from my favorite event series. This is Batman speaking to Superman in Infinite Crisis. Everyone looks up to you. They listen to you. If you tell them to fight, they'll fight. But they need to be inspired. And let's face it, Superman, the last time you really inspired anyone was when you were dead.
And that is from Infinite Crisis, which is also my favorite event book of all time. And I will close it out with the ingredients, in my opinion, for a great event book. And there are always exceptions. I think of something like Identity Crisis as being an exception to this. Something like almost like House of M being an exception to this. But I think that in general, a great event should, like you guys said, have character first. Like Russell said earlier, it should be. I also agree it should be the culmination of something. It should make sense within the story of the characters that are involved. Rather than just being a random event, but I think that action is in general a big part of it. Like an event book should have not necessarily fight scenes all the time, but there should be moving action in the plot continuously throughout the event. Something like Trinity War, something like Forever Evil, to me meet those criteria because to me they had moving action. Infinity Gauntlet, to me, outstanding example because there were so many cool fight scenes, so many cool things happening. It didn't just drag out. And I think that being concise, being efficient, and having something to say with each issue of the event, the worst events would be ones that don't have anything to say, that just that have issues that are meant to pad out. Like, I'll use it as an example, one that was mentioned earlier as a good event. For me, World War Hulk didn't meet the criteria of a great event because it felt padded out. Something like you know, the Infinity Gauntlet, by on the other hand, to me, did not feel padded out. Several of the X-Men events over the years did not feel that way. So anyway, I think we've all brought up some good points about event books. What makes a good event book? What makes a bad event book? We hope you check out some of these great stories we've talked about.
And
some of the bad ones.
And in the future, we discuss on the podcast, be looking forward to the great Green Lantern debate coming in the future.
Indeed. And ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for listening to our long, rambling, long-winded podcast here talking about comics. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Please visit PlaceToBeNation.com. Please go visit your local comic book store and give them some help, and hopefully find some of these great books we've talked about, and kind of see some of the books that made us into the hard-traveling fanboys that we are today. Thanks a lot, guys.